Hello and welcome to the Monster Mechanics Podcast, where we take creatures of myth and media and see how they can be improved. I am your host, Scott Paladin, and with me as always is the blossom to my buttercup, Zach Jakeways.
How's it going?
And with us as never before, the Ursula the Sea Witch to our blossom and buttercup, Richard Quartz Landry.
Hello, you poor unfortunate souls.
And today we are going to be talking about the Baba Yaga. Yes, so the Baba Yaga is a Slavic folklore myth of the, it's basically their, like, their version of the old Wicked Witch kind of concept, specifically how it appears in fairy tales, where you'll go into the woods and find a weird old lady and she'll give you some advice or possibly eat you. That's always the Baba Yaga. Also sometimes pronounced, more properly pronounced, something more like Baba Yaga. So I'm not going to hold either of you or myself to pronouncing anything correctly during this because it's all Slavic in origin. So we have no hope of getting it right. So let's just try to go boldly forward on that one.
And I can't promise I won't go herring off on a third pronunciation. So
yeah. Everything goes. It's fine. So the common features that you're going to see with the Baba Yaga, she is often depicted as flying around in a mortar and pestle. She'll be sitting in the mortar with the pestle in her hand, kind of rowing it like a boat and allows her to fly. She's very often depicted as a very, very ugly old lady, described most often as having bony legs, which is unclear about whether or not that means just very, very thin or if she has actual skeleton feet.
She just got lots of extra bones in her legs.
Dear. Often described as having an incredibly long nose, so long that when she lays on the floor of her hut, the nose sticks into the ceiling, supposedly. And this gives her the ability to smell very well, including specifically to be able to smell Russians. Because obviously,
I mean, that's an important thing when you're. I don't actually know the history here, so I'm just gonna stop.
When you're a wicked old lady in the Slavic woods, in the Russian woods, and you're constantly being harassed by Russian folklore characters, I think it does come in handy occasionally.
It's an important evolutionary trait.
And then I think particularly iconic about Baba Yaga is her house, which is described as being a little hut that walks around on chicken legs. It's also sometimes described as spinning all of the time, and you have to use a little special incantation to get it to stop. But the image of a house walking around on some giant bird legs is really funny.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I mean, chicken isn't the worst possible version, especially if you get like rooster legs with those big old spurs. That's a particularly dangerous combination, especially because they're house sized. I mean, any animal that's house sized gets to be dangerous. But surely that's an avenue for us to approach an improvement immediately. We got to be able to think of some better bird feet to put on this thing.
I mean, the first thing for me that came to mind was actually like a duck, just have a big old webbed feet. And that way, here's the thing. If I know basically nothing about the history of Russia or a lot of like the places west of it in Western Europe. But I do know from all of the sort of generic World War II nerdery that one sort of picks up that the thing that you don't do is start a land war in winter heading east from Western Europe because you're going to have a bad time. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about it and I'm like, okay, if you want something that can walk on top of the snow, what better than giant webbed feet to sort of have like the snowshoe effect?
Built-in snowshoes. That is an excellent specialization for the particularly northern. On that note, you probably could go penguin too, because they've got the webbed feet and they're specifically good on ice.
That's right. I mean, the other option, of course, is to go the complete other direction and just be like, it's a total bird of prey and it will, gut you like a fish. And if it's house, I mean, that's the thing is it's like if it's house size, like you said, it doesn't really matter. It's going to ruin your day anyway.
Zach, what do you have?
So I have a third option, which is the Jacana bird, where you have just a bunch of like. You got these long spindly legs that just look a little nightmarish, but The other thing is it's also carrying its young, like under its wings. So you have all these other feet dangling down there. So maybe it's got like a bunch of sheds or luggage or something stored up underneath the underneath the house. With just all these little bird legs just hanging down like nightmare tentacles.
That's very good. Yeah. If our readers are unfamiliar with the Jacana bird, do a Google image search for them. They carry their young under their wings and it makes the most horrifying imagery.
Yeah. It's like a weird like millipede centaur
It's Lovecraftian. It's awful. So the one I had a couple options. The one that came to mind initially was the cassowary, because cassowaries are basically just Hollywood's versions of velociraptors. They've got these huge scaly feet with massive claws, and they can gut you, like seriously, like very, very dangerous.
Well, it's like you're looking at, you know, like looking at bird feet, as one does when one's doing research for an episode like this. You're looking at pictures and you're like, oh, okay, there's a chicken. And, you know, you're like, oh, okay, here's a bird of prey. And of course, they got the big, you know, like nasty talons that will sink into you or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then you look up the cassowary or the shoebill because you're like, oh, okay, these are the fun birds I've heard of. And you're like, oh, no.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
They're just dinosaurs. Like, I don't, it's almost to the point where you're like, how did anybody not put this together quicker? Like, if somebody had seen a cassowary or a shoebill and then looked at the bones they were digging up out of them in the middle of Montana and they go, you know what? I think these things are still around. Sorry, I've got a dog begging for pets right here, so I have to attend some of my attention to him.
No worries, I understand that entirely. So I think that the house itself is actually just a bird, like it's just a really weird bird.
I'm really digging that idea. Yeah,
I was thinking about it too, where like, you know, there's plenty of organisms that have like parasites in them that sort of kind of cohabitate almost, which I don't know if that's technically a parasite or if that's a,
there's like mutualism, there's parasitism, there's various versions of when they interact with one another. Yeah
But I mean, just imagine that you're like a giant bird, right? And if you're a giant bird that's walking around in the forests or the plains or whatever, you are basically, if someone can take you down, you're going to feed a village for a while.
Yeah.
And so my brain immediately goes to, well, you know, if you're a bird that can get that big, it's going to take you a while to get there. And so you can imagine like, okay, you're running around, everybody's got chickens in these villages or whatever, but there's the birds that can get really big. At a certain point though, it's like once they get to a certain size, they're probably going to get eaten sort of naturally by a bear or a village or whatever, because it takes too much to feed something as they get bigger and bigger and bigger. But if there's no sort of like upper limit on that, giant bird wandering around the woods finds a witch who's like, you know, if you were three times bigger, I could just kind of sit in that little pouch you got there inside your beak and we could just be real good friends. And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And they're just, because there's no upper cap on it, it's just like, well, nobody's going to mess with the witch and the incredibly giant bird, because after the third time that, you know, people go out to get this food and come back turned into toads or whatever curses, you know, they end up with, it's like, well, maybe this just isn't worth it.
That's an interesting idea. I definitely like the idea of the witch house, birdhouse mutualism. The thing that comes to mind to me is I like the idea that, or I would love the approach of the like, she has basically got like a fully formed house. Like it's got shingles and a chimney and a stove inside of it and all that. Maybe that is the domesticated version of whatever this creature is in the wild. Like just like this is the dog version to its wolf, and the wolf version, the wild type, is probably a bit smaller because it wouldn't have been sort of formed for human habitation. And then it would also probably be a lot less hospitable, but still sort of designed to have another creature within it. I wonder if maybe in addition to the protection of having a witch inside of it, maybe these creatures, because they are so unreal, maybe they also require a constant source of magic in order to grow past a certain size. So like maybe at their smallest, they look like my brain wants to go aquatic and say something like a little shell, like a seashell that's got little bird legs sticking out of it. And that, but then if it is inhabited by something that is a natural font of magic, like a pixie or a brownie or something like that, then it starts to sort of adapt itself to being a home for that thing in order to like siphon off its magic.
I wonder, like, in my head, I'm imagining like those sort of wicket is the wrong word, but like the sort of woven sticks and twigs and branches that form sort
like
of
like the bowerbirds.
Yeah, exactly. So where it's like basically a nest on legs.
Yes. Choosing the more powerful magical creature as a form of mate selection. Like, it's basically like, how powerful a magical creature can I have living inside me in order to entice a mate? Like the same way that the bower works.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I love that. That is fantastic.
So, well, and I like the idea too, that that's part of the reason why it has the ability to slowly change the home that it has.
Yeah.
Is it's like, you know, your little tiny ones running around are going to definitely be, you know, like, oh, I've got a cute little mushroom and, you know, I've got like a little mossy thing going on. So there's little tiny fairies that come.
Yeah.
But eventually you get the, like, I don't know what the European version of a tanuki is. I don't know if there are raccoons in that area, but you know, like the magic marmoset or whatever the heck, you know, weird mammal is out there. You know, or whatever has, you know, a bigger thing and its nest looks a little different.
Yeah.
And I think maybe like if this is a species that wants to create more of itself by attracting more magical inhabitants, do we think that they're just sort of siphoning off a little bit of the magic energy and then it just sort of like buds, or these things lay little eggs houses or something like that? Like, how do more of these show up, I guess, is the question I have.
I love the angle of it being a sexual selection process where they have to mate in order to, because they're showing off their magical creature. Do we want something that's like still house themed for the reproduction, or should it be more biological, do you think?
Well, I think the natural order of things, the way that house themed things happen, is there's a bubble and then the bubble bursts and then people like me can afford to buy a house 20 minutes out of the city. And then that turns into an hour. Oh, we're talking about magical creatures. Sorry. Right.
That's the very Pratchett way to approach it. Let's start with the pun and go from there.
Yeah. But gosh, no, I mean, I do kind of like the idea of a bubble though, like just as a funny thematic element.
It's sort of cause bubbles have a sort of, or amphibian, eggs have a kind of bubble like quality to them. They got that they've got that translucent quality that where you can see the inside of it. That's kind of cool.
Just a bunch of bricks floating in an amniotic sac.
Well, I like, my brain is immediately going to this process though of like, okay, so you have these two houses and they sort of like wander around, and then when they see another house that they like, it's like there's something where like they come together and then there's immediately like a magic bubble that forms around them. And like whatever magic creatures are there sort of like fall asleep for a moment, and nobody actually knows how this works, but like it forms a magic bubble. And so you may, like, if you're wandering through the woods and you come across this like this weird sort of like, you know, bubble in the middle of nowhere. You're like, okay, it is time to go away because this is going to be bad if I don't. But it just sort of like hangs out there. And then eventually the two birdhouses sort of, or the huts or whatever you want to call them, just sort of like step out of it, you know, like through one of those membranes or something, like, like going through a gooey curtain wall. You know, with the,
all that's left is a studio apartment,
the bee curtain. Yeah. And then inside, and then inside is just like this baby house bird thing, inside of this magic bubble that is protecting them.
Yeah.
And then there's got to be some, like, and then the magical creatures that are inhabiting the two that came together, like, they wake up and they're like, oh, okay, well, here's a new one. This is just a thing that happens. The thing I want to know is, like, is there some other benefit that the magical creatures get from being sort of a part of this process other than just, hey, I've got a cool magical home that can, you know, murder anything smaller than it? Or
there's definitely the benefit of having a house on the go, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you're not tied down to a particular area. And that, especially if you think of magical users as having sort of a range that they need to take care of, or that they, mm-hmm. you know, if you're, especially if you're something like a witch that's going to be gathering a lot of ingredients over a wide, mm-hmm. A wide area, you probably want to have that range. And it could also be a reverse status, like the bird is using the, magic user as a status symbol. The status, magic user could also be using the bird as a status symbol too.
Yeah.
Sort of show off how nice and lovely their home is, as a sort of, hey, look what I've got. It's the, mine's already it's got,
they chose me.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, look at this, lovely, granite countertops that I've got in it. And like, I mean, just like anybody does
right.
The Instagram homes, the Pinterest homes that people have these days.
I was gonna say, I also like the idea that maybe the magical creatures also like get magically crossbred this way. Like when the houses do their thing, like there's also like, so you have like a hag in one house and like a fairy in the other one. Mm-hmm. And then you get some weird third magical beast out of that.
Oh,
it's sort of like how the monsters are populated through that region.
Oh, interesting. That's kind of cool.
So it's both. So the new house comes with a new inhabitant.
Yeah. Interesting. And it's just kind of splicing these magical beings whenever the houses reproduce.
You know, you could go even further in that direction where the house and the creature that lives within it, the Baba Yaga and the house, are the same creature. Like they are not just two species that are symbiotically intertwined, but are in fact maybe it's the same multidimensional creature. Like if they're fifth dimensional and like this is just where they are intersecting with our dimension. You see the house version and the Baba Yaga version, but there's actually the same organism. They can't one can't exist without the other.
So it's sort of your like weird interdimensional siphonophore type deal where it's like the two pieces of this organism are distinct if you look at it in a particular way, but it can't function without both pieces.
Yeah. Or like, I mean, down to us and mitochondria, you know, where like they are, for all intents and purposes, they're just their own little thing inhabiting our cells. But if we got rid of them, we'd die.
Yeah.
That could be very cool. I'm also kind of, and this reverses on some of the stuff we've been talking about before, but I'm kind of interested in the idea of them as hermit crabs. Where whatever creature this thing is, it inhabits a vessel like a house, but that it's really just sort of inserting itself into this otherwise empty, mundane vessel. And then when it outgrows it, it has to go find a new one and like insert itself into that.
So I'm just now imagining a pair of giant bird legs attached to like an amorphous sort of mass of writhing, it would be like a ball, right? A ball of meat.
Yeah.
And then I'm just imagining like coming out of that are like a mass of like coxcombs, right?
Okay.
But they've got all the little, you know, fingery type things coming out of them. But then like those aren't necessarily strictly they don't behave in the way that you would expect. So it's like it'll stick a couple, you know, it'll stick itself into the bottom of whatever house thing it wants to inhabit. And then those things just sort of like spread out throughout it.
Yes.
And so you can imagine. Yeah, it's like you can imagine like a nest, right? Mm-hmm. Like if it was a bird nest for some sort of other magical thing. And then if you look closely at it, between all of the twigs and bits of shiny things or whatever are these weird red fleshy bits. And if you poke them, they will sort of like wiggle and wriggle, and then you'll get the crap murdered out of you by the legs. But, you know.
Yeah. I definitely love the idea of them having to switch out, because you could just imagine some farmers one day who are sitting in their little farmhouse, mm-hmm. and this and a slightly smaller farmhouse on giant cassowary legs bonks mm-hmm. up, sort of measures itself against them, and then upturns their house, mm-hmm. dumps off the smaller one, and then like right, and then it just taking the new house stands up and walks away, and they're like, well, what did like now I've we well, just got downgraded.
I wonder too, like you know, I know in various parts of the world, there are houses that are built on stilts specifically to avoid like flooding and all that.
Yeah.
Where if you don't want that to happen, the architectural practices become important, right? Oh, if you're going to do, you know, like a Scottish crofter's hut or whatever, right, where it's all stone mm-hmm. and mortared together and all that, where it's literally just, you know, like a shell of a bunch of rocks put together on top of dirt. It's going to be tougher for one of these creatures to burrow under it to do that.
I'm picturing you've seen like those strips that they put down to like keep birds from like perching on like fences. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, but in reverse.
Yeah.
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 Your foundation is just a bunch of spikes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and then I know there are those like burrowing owls. Now, I don't know how much they burrow themselves or how much they're taking over from other creatures.
I'm pretty sure they take over, but they still use it.
But it would be deeply funny to me if there were some sort of like burrowing mole creature, some sort of large burrowing mole creature or gopher creature mm-hmm. that then these had sort of a symbiotic relationship with of, well, they dig these things under people's houses. And then occasionally one of the birds will just go and crawl down in there and just go pop and then walk off with the house.
Or like, your people are just forbidden from building basements in their houses because that just always ends poorly.
Mm-hmm. You're asking for it then.
You get one hut infestation and it's all over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reminded also of one of the few facts I know about hermit crabs, which is that sometimes a hermit crab finds a shell that's too big for it. It'll kind of hang around and wait for one that comes in between. And you'll end up with these chains.
Conga lines.
Yeah, conga line, where the biggest hermit crab will get into a new shell. And then the next biggest one will go into the old shell of the previous one. And you'll get them all trading up. And I kind of love the visual of that with a bunch of these bird-like houses.
And that's how these, so there's got to be like towns that have formed that way, right? Of it's just like you're
a village going along.
And
do you think they have an HOA?
Well, and I think what would happen is it's like there would just be these places where there would be sort of discarded houses and they would tend to be the small ones, right?
Yeah.
And they're just in a row. And so you'll be going down the road and you'll see one of these and you'll know that it's like, okay, this is a place that is probably fine most of the time. But every once in a while, like the traveler's wisdom is that like, okay, if you're in one of these abandoned rest houses or rest stops or whatever, and you feel the ground moving, get out while you can. But then you can stay and watch the show. And, you know, there's got to be like some sort of, you know, thing that you do when you go to one of these rest stops. It's like you always have a bit of, I don't know, mint on you or something, because they don't like mint. And so you can, you know, if this is happening, you can cross to the other side of the road and rub yourself with mint and just watch this amazing thing, right? And it becomes like almost a cool thing that you can do.
So I'm wondering, what's the upper is there an upper limit? Like, is there a point where these things stop working? Could we have castles walking around on giant bird legs?
Skyscrapers on chicken.
My brain immediately went to Howl's Moving Castle.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Of course.
Because of course it did. I think the amount of magic it would take to do that might be the limiting factor.
Yeah.
Because there's just not a lot of things that powerful, maybe. Yeah. Although,
or like maybe it requires something big, like an entire court of fairies living inside of a castle.
Or maybe that goes back to the legend of like Baba Yaga being like a coven of three witches.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where it takes several mm-hmm. things to do that. The other thing is, if you want to talk about something like, I recently watched the Castlevania series from Netflix with the big traveling castle, right? That does the idea of like, okay, so that would be an incredibly powerful vampire, might be something that might take up residence in one of these and allow it to mm-hmm. grow big, or something like a dragon.
Yeah.
You can imagine like a dragon's horde in one of these traveling creatures where the dragon doesn't even have to do much most of the time, because, you know, this thing will just, you know, kick anything that tries to come and steal the horde.
Or like you mentioned the vampire, and it makes me think mm-hmm. of the idea of a creature that has like been riding this bird house a little too mm-hmm. long, and it's gotten a little too big and it can't quite sustain itself anymore. And it makes me think mm-hmm. of an evil witch who like goes out and captures other magical creatures in order to sort of feed them to the house mm-hmm. and maintain and like let it grow bigger and stronger because they can't maintain it themselves anymore. Mm-hmm. That's an excellent story hook.
Yeah, where it's like, oh, okay, you know, that's where the adventurers come in. If you want to run something like that, is, oh, okay, well, the reason that the advertisement was put out for, or the call was put out for adventurers, is because usually there's a couple of spellcasters in those groups and they're tasty.
Yeah. I dig that. Yeah. So, okay. So we mentioned these things as a flocking creatures, but we're still sort of thinking about them as being parasitic off of off of magical creatures. Do you think do those counteract each other in a way? Like, are they, because we're not normally going to see a large population of magic users like walking around in a village, like hanging out in these things. Are we still thinking they're more solitary, or do they?
I think it just depends on like the general like ambient level of magical creatures in an area or the population. So the wild places where,
yeah, okay, where there's just a lot more background magic.
Yeah. Or, okay. Or, you know, if there's, it's the classic, oh, paved over all the stuff and we've, you know, quote unquote civilized the things, but, you know, okay, if there's an urban center where there's not as many sort of magical creatures, or the ones that are there are sort of the little tiny pests, you're going to end up with you're going to end up with rat nests of, you know, mind rats or whatever the heck they are, mm-hmm. brain rats. And that will be a problem, but you're not going to end up with, the fake horde showing up in your deep, dark forest and causing a bunch of problems. And, you end up with the pigeon version versus the, you know, murder of crows hanging out in the forest who were like, hey, you, what are you doing in our forest?
I do like the idea of an offshoot species that's just remains small and it lures in animals and then eats them. Like it's just mm-hmm. like sits there and hides its little bird legs underneath itself as a little den and waits for a rat or something to come by. And then like, you know, rat comes in, investigates and like, you know, antlion style, just, you know, gobbles them up.
Yeah.
I also like the idea sort of like the murder of crows kind of sparked an idea. Like, what if there's some that just kind of collect magic items rather than creatures?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So like you'll have one that's just like collecting shinies, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you end up with like this traveling hut that's full of magic items.
But it's very dangerous, because probably one of the ways it gets magic items is waiting for adventurers to come in and take the other ones and then killing them and keeping their magical items.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, the other thing I was thinking about too is like squirrels, right? Where like they'll hide things to eat later. Mm-hmm. And so
yeah.
You can imagine that if there's an adventuring season, right? So if the summer and spring and, you know, early fall are sort of adventuring season, sort of like in what is it, Pendragon that does that, where there's the, you sit around for half of the game, you know, rolling up, what are we doing in winter? Well, we're, you know, drinking and making eyes at each other. But the adventuring season is when you can actually go around because you're not snowed in. So having like the part of the year when they're going around, they're finding magical items, they're hoarding them, they're kind of eating on them or they're gnawing on them.
Yeah.
But they don't want to hold too much because then they become a target.
Yeah.
And so they hide them. And just like, you know, and squirrels do.
And during the like high magic season, during the adventuring season, there are other magical beings out and around that are not pulled up. So it's easier to sustain your stuff on those. And you can't keep those, but you can keep the magical items. Mm-hmm. Those will store.
Right. So there are snacks for later.
Yeah.
And then you forget them. And so that's how you get all of these stories of, oh, I was wandering through the woods one day to, you know, find some berries. And all of a sudden I found this, you know, magic hairbrush. And it's like, yeah. Why would there be a magic hairbrush in the woods? Well, because one of these things, you know, ate the magic bard who had to look fancy for going out into the woods to kill magical creatures.
I like that. Hidden.
I also like the idea of like parasites or on these wandering huts that are kind of just adapted to fit with like the home motif. So you've got kind of like the Terry Pratchett style, like chest with a bunch of legs or whatever, that kind of fills the function of like a mite or, you know, lice or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or something that, I'm trying to think of what would be a good option for this, but something that sort of acts as its arms, you know, that will go out and grab the, you know, reach outside of the house and act on it like a little, my mind is going towards the Ottoman dog from Beauty and the Beast for some reason, but that's not a super, it doesn't have hands.
Right.
But something that would be sort of domestic, but could be an actor for it.
An agent. I wonder if part of that is the magical creatures that it likes to attract, because, you know, the larger ones are going to be able to attract people-sized things. And obviously a person can do that. But, you know, if you've got, you know, if you're really small and you've got magic, you know, rats or dormice, like they have clever little hands, they can go and they can grab things, and then starting to go up more, you get into the raccoon territory.
And there's also plenty of small humanoid creatures that are, you know, like gnomes and pixies and brownies and knockers and gremlins and goblins. Like there's you know, especially in Western folklore, there's all these little creatures which are all kind of the same thing, fairies and red caps, and like there's a whole plethora. You could really go up in size from, there's a nice gradient, you go all the way up to a, you know, probably get it, end up to a giant if you got a house big enough.
I wonder too if then, you know, like if the dragon type thing where it's like, okay, it's a huge hoard of magic items, if that attracts these sort of things.
If they like, can sort of smell it.
And so in some ways, it's like if you have a dragon in your area, you have less of these things wandering around because it's, you know, they've sort of
competition.
Right. And so a dragon's going around and saying, oh, OK, so you actually don't have to worry about your house being picked up and moved by one of these things if you have a local dragon. And so it ends up sort of being that kind of like balance of, well,
yeah.
I mean, we've got a mongoose that's, you know, 100 feet long, breathes fire, wants all of our gold occasionally, and, you know, we'll eat a cow every now and again, but we don't have to worry about our houses getting up and walking away.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit of a trade-off. And it might even be like a cultural thing too, right? Like if
some people prefer one.
Yeah, or like if you've lived in an area that has something like this, like a dragon, where you don't have to worry about these creatures, or you live in a place that has always had these houses that sort of like get up and move, you might go somewhere else and be like, wait, all these houses are, you know, too, like they're this architecture doesn't make sense, or
do you mean, like, you have city planning?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, wait, everything is so organized. This is wigging me out. And it's because they don't have to deal with that.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about the, we've been mostly talking about sort of the wild type version of this, the one that kind of does what it wants. But like this, as I think is obvious from the Baba Yaga, you can have like the domesticated version that sort of is the dog to these things, wolves, where it listens to you and is like interested in your needs and stuff like that, and has a sort of more symbiotic cultural relationship with you. And you could have that would be an interesting aspect to a larger culture. I'm thinking about like the steppe peoples of Central Europe who are hugely intertwined with their reindeer. And like, so there are these herding populations who live on the move all of the time. And for something like that, a house that moves with you and like you didn't have to take down and set up like a yurt from place to place would be super useful. And then, like, I kind of love the idea of if you're adventuring through, you know, a steppe like area and you come across what looks like a village with a big herd of reindeer or something outside of it. And then like when the reindeer are ready to move, all of the houses get up and they all move along and they use them to herd the reindeer and everything. That'd be super cool.
Oh my gosh. You get basically like a cowboy thing, but a bunch of, you know, people hanging out in like little.
Oh God, a Western town with the saloon and the brothel and everything that all gets up and moves with the cows.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm even imagining too, like what if like yurts or tents or something like because they're domesticated, what if those are all made of that like coxcomb skin stuff?
Oh, okay.
And so like, it's sort of a thing where it is the actual house as well. And so like there are materials that you put in there to help feed it or keep it or whatever. But it's like you encounter a thing where it's like you see these tents and you just see someone walk up to it and just sort of like, oh, and then it opens up and you're like, oh no, that's that's not okay.
And it's all fleshy inside.
Yeah. you're just hanging out in there and it's like on a bright day you can just see the veins through your tent.
It's got to be warm, right? Because it's gonna you're living inside of a creature. It's like a Han on Hoth all over again, getting inside. And
I thought they smelled bad on the actually, I mean, that's honestly though, if you're living in a place where it gets really cold, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah,
so then I would imagine then too, if you're talking about a culture that domesticates these things and everything, then there becomes a culture for the magic use
to sustain
there that sort of, that sort of ties into that. And so you get sort of these people who have a magic tradition around sort of a symbiotic relationship with other creatures. And you can imagine if you were going to, you know, if you were going to write a gaming supplement or something for this, you would have these people who their whole deal is communicating with magic creatures and, you know, whatever your, hey, we live on the plains thing is
that
isn't just, hey, we're Mongols.
Yeah, no, I think cowboy angle is the way to go on that one still, because it's all fiction anyway. Cowboys were never really like they existed for about 20 years. Until the West was tamed. And you can just appropriate the crap out of that. I give you full permission as a Texan to do that. Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Richard, can you tell people where to find you on the internet if they want to hear more from you?
I mean, if they really want to, you can find me at R. Kreutzlandry on Twitter. Pretty much there you'll find all my stuff. I'm a software engineer by day, but in my spare time I do origami art. And most recently, the last couple of years, I've been doing game design. The big game that I'm working on currently with Rich Howard and Taylor LaBresche is Descent into Midnight. It's about psionic alien sea creatures defending their aquatic home from an existential threat. So you can imagine, you know, I really like Flipper, but I'd like it to be with psionics, or I saw The Abyss and it freaked me out as a kid. I'd like to play in that, please. You can do the thing.
Yeah. If you're listening to Monster Mechanics, there are lots of tonal thematies, similarities.
The Leviathan episode, like if you liked what happened in the Leviathan episode, that is the exact kind of thing that you do, in the world building and the character building for Descent into Midnight. Like literally you could take what y'all came up with for that episode and say, yes, I am playing that as a character. I am absolutely this big, giant mass of stuff hanging out at hydrothermal vents. that occasionally sort of like goops off into other things. I am playing that as a character. I am psionic. And oh, by the way, all the other instances of me across the planet are also the same character. And I'm just a thing that happens and that actually works in the game. And you can also be like, oh yeah, and my buddy here is literally just Flipper with a bad attitude who's psychic. And it works.
I am super impressed with the ability for Descent and Midnight to handle those just the wildly different characters. And
always wanted to play a buddy dolphin game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'll have to shout out one of, I think it's one of the origins for one of the playbooks is just too many teeth as a place. Which I'm
yeah.
Like, yeah. The moment I heard that, I'm like, I have to play this.
Well, that's the thing about the Powered by the Apocalypse pick list is you can kind of put whatever you want in there. And we originally started with things like, you know, a kelp forest or a deep crevasse. And Taylor, who is our sort of he's our design lead, mm-hmm. Was writing these and going, OK, but what if I put stuff like, you know, too many teeth? And we're like, yeah, that actually kind of works. And then like almost every time something, one of those things gets picked because it's so evocative.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an answer that is not an answer. It's just more questions.
Right.
And that causes people to start trying to answer those questions and that mm-hmm. gets them engaged in the character immediately. It's a beautiful piece of game design. Well, excellent. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Scott Paladin. Zach.
I'm at Pictoglyphic on Twitter.
Awesome. And with that, bye.
Till next time.
See ya.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Monster Mechanics. Monster Mechanics is produced and edited by me, Scott Paladin, and hosted by myself and my best friend, Zach Jakeways. All of the ideas generated during this podcast are released under a Do What the F*** You Want public license.